and a high carbohydrate diet, for that matter, are among the most prominent stimulators of inflammatory pathways that reach the brain. What's most disturbing about this discovery, however, is that we often don't know when our brains are being negatively affected. Digestive disorders and food allergies are much easier to spot because symptoms such as gas, bloating, pain, constipation, and diarrhea emerge relatively quickly. But the brain is a more elusive organ. It could be enduring assaults at a molecular level without your feeling it. Unless you're nursing a headache or managing a neurological problem that's clearly evident, it can be hard to know what's going on in the brain until it's too late. When it comes to brain disease, once the diagnosis is in for something like dementia, turning the train around is hard. The good news is that I'm going to show you how to control your genetic destiny even if you were born with a natural tendency to develop a neurological challenge. This will require that you free yourself from a few myths so many people continue to cling to. The two biggest ones. 1. A low-fat, high-carb diet is good. And 2. Cholesterol is bad. The story doesn't end with the elimination of gluten. Gluten is just one piece of the puzzle. In the upcoming chapters, you'll soon understand why cholesterol is one of the most important players in maintaining brain health and function. Study after study shows that high cholesterol reduces your risk for brain disease and increases longevity. By the same token, high levels of dietary fat, the good kind, no trans fats here, have been proven to be key to health and peak brain function. Say what? I realize you may doubt these statements because they run so contrary to what you've been taught to believe. One of the most prized and respected studies ever done in America, the famous Framingham Heart Study, has added volumes of data to our understanding of certain risk factors for disease, including, most recently, dementia. It commenced in 1948 with the recruitment of 5,209 men and women between the ages of 30 and 62 from the town of Framingham, Massachusetts, none of whom had yet suffered a heart attack or stroke or even developed symptoms of cardiovascular disease. Since then, the study has added multiple generations stemming from the original group, which has allowed scientists to carefully monitor these populations and gather clues to physiological conditions within the context of myriad factors: age, gender, psychosocial issues, physical traits, and genetic patterns. In the mid-2000s, researchers at Boston University set out to examine the relationship between total cholesterol and cognitive performance, and they looked at 789 men and 1,105 women who were part of the original group. All of the individuals were free of dementia and stroke at the beginning of the study and were followed for 16 to 18 years. Cognitive tests were performed every 4 to 6 years, evaluating things like memory, learning, concept formation, concentration, attention, abstract reasoning, and organizational abilities. All the features that are compromised in patients with Alzheimer's disease. According to the study's report, published in 2005, there was a significant positive linear association between total cholesterol and measures of verbal fluency, attention, concentration, abstract reasoning, and a composite score measuring multiple cognitive domains. Moreover, participants with desirable total cholesterol, less than 200, performed less well than participants with borderline high total cholesterol levels, 200 to 239, and participants with high total cholesterol levels, greater than 240. The study concluded that lower naturally occurring total cholesterol levels are associated with poor performance on cognitive measures, which placed high demand on abstract reasoning, attention, concentration, word fluency, and executive functioning. In other words, the people who had the highest cholesterol levels scored higher on cognitive tests than those with lower levels. Evidently, there is a protective factor when it comes to cholesterol and the brain. We'll be exploring how this is possible in Chapter 3. The research keeps coming from various labs around the world, flipping conventional wisdom on its head. As I write this, researchers with Australian National University in Canberra just published a study in the journal Neurology, the medical journal of the American Academy of Neurology, showing that people whose blood sugar is on the high end of the normal range have a much greater risk for brain shrinkage. This ties directly into the story of type 3 diabetes. We've known for a long time that brain disorders and dementia are associated with brain shrinkage, but knowing now that such shrinkage can happen as a result of blood sugar spikes in the normal range has tremendous implications for anyone who eats blood sugar-boosting foods. That is, carbohydrates. So often, my patients will tell me that they are fine because their blood sugar is normal. But what is normal? The lab test may indicate that an individual is normal by established standards, but new science is forcing us to reconsider normal parameters. Your blood sugar may be normal, but if you could peek into your pancreas, you might be aghast at how much it's struggling to pump out enough insulin to keep you on an even keel. For this reason, getting a fasting insulin test, which is done first thing in the morning before eating a meal, is critical. An elevated level of insulin in your blood at this time is a red flag, a sign that something isn't metabolically right. You could be on the verge of diabetes, already depriving your brain of its future functionality. The Australian study involved 249 people age 60 to 64 who had blood sugar in the so-called normal range and who underwent brain scans at the start of the study and again an average of 4 years later. Those with higher blood sugar levels within the normal range were more likely to show a loss of brain volume in regions involved with memory and cognitive skills. The researchers even managed to factor out other influences, such as age, high blood pressure, smoking, and alcohol use. Still, they found that blood sugar on the high end of normal accounted for 6 to 10% of the brain shrinkage. The study suggests that blood sugar levels could have an impact on brain health, even for people who do not have diabetes. Blood sugar and insulin imbalances are epidemic. Within the next decade, one in two Americans will suffer from diabesity, the term now used to describe a range of metabolic imbalances from mild insulin resistance to prediabetes to full-blown diabetes. The hardest fact of all to accept is that a breathtaking 90% of these people will not be diagnosed. They will carry on and come to learn of their predicament when it's far too late. My mission is to interrupt such an unfortunate destiny. We want to focus not on calling all the king's horses and all the king's men, but on coaxing Humpty Dumpty down from the wall before disaster strikes. This will require a shift in a few daily habits. If the thought of going on a low-carb diet is terrifying, you're already biting your nails at the thought of nixing all the delicious foods you've come to love. Don't give up yet. I promise to make this as easy as possible. I might take away the breadbasket, but I'll replace it with other things you might have avoided under the false idea that they were somehow bad for you, such as butter, meat, cheese, and eggs, as well as an abundance of wonderfully healthful vegetables. The best news of all is that as soon as you shift your body's metabolism from relying on carbs to relying on fat and protein, you'll find a lot of desirable goals easier to achieve, such as losing weight effortlessly and permanently, gaining more energy throughout the day, sleeping better, being more creative and productive, having a sharper memory and faster brain, and enjoying a better sex life. This, of course, is in addition to safeguarding your brain. Inflammation gets cerebral. Let's get back to this idea of inflammation, which I've mentioned a few times in this chapter without a full explanation. Everyone has a pretty good idea what is meant by the term inflammation in a very general sense. whether it's the redness that quickly appears after an insect bite or the chronic soreness of an arthritic joint, most of us understand that when there is some kind of stress in the body, our body's natural response is to create swelling and pain, hallmarks of the inflammatory process. But inflammation isn't always a negative reaction. It can also serve as an indication that the body is trying to defend itself against something it believes to be potentially harmful. Whether to neutralize the insect's toxins or reduce movement in a sprained ankle to allow healing, inflammation is vital to our survival. Problems arise, however, when inflammation gets out of control. Just as one glass of wine is healthy, but multiple glasses can lead to health risks, the same holds true for inflammation. Inflammation is meant to be a spot treatment. It's not supposed to be turned on for prolonged periods of time, and never forever. But that's what's happening in millions of people. If the body is constantly under assault by exposure to irritants, the inflammation response stays on, and it spreads to every part of the body through the bloodstream. Hence, we have the ability to detect this kind of widespread inflammation through blood tests. When inflammation goes awry, a variety of chemicals are produced that are directly toxic to our cells. This leads to a reduction of cellular function followed by cellular destruction. Unbridled inflammation is rampant in Western cultures, with leading scientific research showing that it is a fundamental cause of the morbidity and mortality associated with coronary artery disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, and virtually every other chronic disease you can imagine. It's not much of a stretch to appreciate how unchecked inflammation would underlie a problem like arthritis, for example. After all, the common drugs used to treat the condition, such as ibuprofen and aspirin, are marketed as anti-inflammatories. With asthma, antihistamines are used to combat the inflammatory reaction that occurs when someone is exposed to an irritant that elicits an allergic response. These days, more and more people are beginning to understand that coronary artery disease, a leading cause of heart attacks, may actually have more to do with inflammation than it does with high cholesterol. This explains why aspirin, in addition to its blood-thinning properties, is useful in reducing risk not only for heart attacks, but also for strokes. But the connection of inflammation to brain diseases, although well described in the scientific literature, seems somehow difficult to embrace, and it's largely unknown by the public. Perhaps one reason people can't seem to envision brain inflammation as being involved in everything from Parkinson's disease to multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, autism, Alzheimer's disease, and depression is that unlike the rest of the body, the brain has no pain receptors, so we can't feel inflammation in the brain. Focusing on reducing inflammation might seem out of place in a discussion of enhancing brain health and function. But while we are all familiar with inflammation as it relates to such disease states as arthritis and asthma, the past decade has produced an extensive body of research clearly pointing the finger of causality at inflammation when considering a variety of neurodegenerative conditions. In fact, studies dating back as far as the 1990s show that people who have taken non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, such as Advil, ibuprofen, and Aleve, naproxen, for 2 or more years, may have more than a 40% reduced risk for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. At the same time, other studies have clearly shown dramatic elevation of cytokines, the cellular mediators of inflammation, in the brains of individuals suffering from these and other degenerative brain disorders. Today, new imaging technology is finally allowing us to see cells actively involved in producing inflammatory cytokines in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. So, we now are forced to regard inflammation in a whole new light. Far more than just the cause of your painful knee and sore joints, it underpins the very process of brain degeneration. Ultimately, the key downstream effect of inflammation in the brain that is responsible for the damage is activation of chemical pathways that increase free radical production. At the center of chronic inflammation is the concept of oxidative stress, a biological type of rusting. This rusting can happen on the outside, causing wrinkles and premature aging, and on the inside, where it can stiffen your blood vessels, damage cell membranes, erode your intestinal wall, and essentially wreak havoc on your tissues and organs. Oxidation is a normal part of life. It happens everywhere in nature. It occurs during the natural process of metabolism, which is simply the body's means of turning calories, energy from food, and oxygen from the air into energy usable by the body. Oxidation, then, is very much a part of our being, but when it begins to run rampant, or when there's too much oxidation without a balance of antioxidant action, it can become harmful. The word oxidation obviously implies oxygen, but not the kind we breathe. The form of oxygen that's the culprit here is simply O, because it's not paired with another oxygen molecule, O2. Let me take you one step further in describing the oxidation process. Most of us have heard about free radicals by now. These are molecules that have lost an electron. Normally, electrons spin around in pairs, but forces such as stress, pollution, chemicals, toxic dietary triggers, ultraviolet sunlight, and ordinary body activities, even breathing, can make one of them break off. When that happens, the molecule loses all sense of propriety and starts ricocheting around, trying to steal electrons from other molecules. This commotion is the oxidation process itself, a chain of events that attacks cells and kicks off inflammation, which creates more free radicals. Because oxidized tissues and cells don't function normally, the whole destructive process sets you up for a slew of health challenges. The body is constantly trying to heal itself and repair DNA damage, yet it lacks the right tools to do this completely. It's no wonder that people with high levels of oxidation have an extensive list of symptoms: fatigue, brain fog, low resistance to infection, muscle weakness, joint pain, digestive disorders, acne, anxiety, headaches, depression, irritability, allergies. The list goes on. And, as you probably can guess, anything that reduces oxidation reduces inflammation, and anything that reduces inflammation reduces oxidation. That's partly why antioxidants are so important. These unselfish nutrients, including vitamins A, C, and E, donate electrons to free radicals, and this interrupts the chain reaction and helps prevent damage. Historically, we ate food rich in antioxidants, such as plants, berries, and nuts. The food industry today processes a lot of nutrients out of our diets that are sorely needed for optimal health and energy metabolism. Later in this book, I'm going to show you how to turn on a particular pathway in your body that not only directly reduces free radicals naturally, but also protects the brain by reducing excess free radicals produced by inflammation. Interventions designed to reduce inflammation using natural substances like turmeric have been described in medical literature dating back more than 2,000 years, but it is only in the past decade that we have begun to understand this intricate and eloquent biochemistry. Another upshot of this biological pathway is the activation of specific genes that code for the production of enzymes and other chemicals that serve to break down and eliminate various toxins to which we are exposed. One might wonder why human DNA would contain codes for the production of detoxification chemicals, because we tend to assume that our first real exposure to toxins began with the industrial era. But humans, and in fact all living things, have been exposed to a variety of toxins for as long as there has been life on the planet. Aside from toxins that naturally exist in our external environment, like lead, arsenic, and aluminum, as well as powerful toxins created as a form of protection by variously consumed plants and animals, our bodies produce toxins internally during the normal processes of metabolism. So these detoxification genes, now needed more than ever, have gratefully served us for a very long time. And we are just beginning to understand how natural substances you can buy at your local grocery store, such as turmeric and the omega-3 docosahexaenoic acid, DHA, can act as powerful detoxification agents by enhancing genetic expression. It is not just what we eat that can change the expression of our genes and therefore help us manage inflammation. You're going to learn about the latest studies demonstrating the ways exercise and sleep come into play, as these are important regulators, read, remote controllers, of our DNA. What's more, you'll learn how to grow new brain cells. I'm going to show you how and why neurogenesis, the birth of new brain cells, is under your control. The cruel irony. Statins. Diet and exercise can boost our body's natural methods to manage inflammation, but is there also a case for drugs? Far from it. Ironically, cholesterol-lowering statins, which are among the most commonly prescribed drugs, for example, Lipitor, Crestor, Zocor, are now being touted as a way to reduce overall levels of inflammation. But new research also reveals that statins may lessen brain function and increase risk for heart disease. The reason is simple. The brain needs cholesterol to thrive, a point I've already made, but will repeat to make sure you don't forget it. Cholesterol is a critical brain nutrient essential for the function of neurons, and it plays a fundamental role as a building block of the cell membrane. It acts as an antioxidant and a precursor to important brain-supporting elements like vitamin D, as well as the steroid-related hormones, for example, sex hormones such as testosterone and estrogen. Most important, cholesterol is looked upon as an essential fuel for the neurons. Neurons themselves are unable to generate significant cholesterol. Instead, they rely on delivery of cholesterol from the bloodstream via a specific carrier protein. Interestingly, this carrier protein, LDL, has been given the derogatory title of bad cholesterol. In reality, LDL is not a cholesterol molecule at all, good or bad. It's a low-density lipoprotein, hence its acronym, and there is absolutely nothing bad about it. The fundamental role of LDL in the brain, again, is to capture life-giving cholesterol and transport it to the neuron, where it performs critically important functions. And now, we have the evidence in the scientific literature to prove that when cholesterol levels are low, the brain simply doesn't work well. Individuals with low cholesterol are at much greater risk for dementia and other neurological problems. We need to change our attitudes about cholesterol and even LDL. They are our friends, not foes. But what about cholesterol and coronary artery disease? I'm going to tackle that very conundrum in Chapter 3. For now, I want to implant in your brain the idea that cholesterol is good. You'll soon see that we've been barking up the wrong tree, blaming cholesterol and LDL especially, when coronary artery disease has more to do with oxidized LDL. And how does LDL become so damaged that it's no longer able to deliver cholesterol to the brain? One of the most common ways is through physical modification by glucose. Sugar molecules attach themselves to LDL and change the molecule's shape, rendering it less useful while increasing free radical production. If what I just described to you raced past your head, don't panic. I'm going to take you by the hand through all of these biological events in the upcoming chapters. I've broadly touched upon a lot of issues in this chapter as a prelude to the balance of the book, which will take you deeper into the story of Grain Brain. The chief questions I want you to think about are, have we accelerated our brain's decline by following a low-fat, high-carb diet with fruit on the side? Can we really control the fate of our brains through lifestyle alone, despite the DNA we've inherited? Is there too much invested interest in big pharma to consider the fact we can naturally prevent, treat, and sometimes cure, without drugs, a spectrum of brain-based ailments such as ADHD, depression, anxiety, insomnia, autism, Tourette syndrome, headaches, and Alzheimer's disease? The answer to all three of these questions is a resounding yes. I'll go even further and suggest we can prevent heart disease and diabetes too. The current model of treatment for these maladies pays too much attention to the symptomatic smoke and ignores the smoldering fire. Such an approach is ineffective and unsustainable. If we're ever going to push the boundaries of human longevity, live long past 100 years old, and really have something amazing to report to our prehistoric ancestors, then we're going to have to change our whole MO. The goal of this chapter was to explain the story of inflammation and introduce you to a new way of thinking and looking at your brain and body. We take it for granted that the sun rises in the east every morning and sets in the west at night. The next day, the sun does the same thing again. But what if I told you that the sun isn't moving at all? It's us who are spinning and moving around the sun. I trust you already knew that, but the point of the analogy is that we tend to get mentally wedded to ideas that are no longer valid. After lectures, people frequently approach me to say thanks for thinking outside the box. With all due respect, that's not the point. It does the world no good to be seen as someone whose ideas are outside the box. My mission is to make the box bigger so that these concepts are part of our culture and way of living. Only then will we be able to make serious, meaningful headway with our modern afflictions. From brain health to total health. The inescapable fact is that we have evolved into a species that requires fat for life and health. The massive amounts of carbs we eat today are fueling a silent firestorm in our bodies and brains. And I'm not just talking about the manufactured, refined stuff that we all know is not going to win prizes for us at the doctor's office, much less on the scale. I love how Dr. William Davis puts it in his seminal work, Wheat Belly. Whether it's a loaf of organic, high-fiber, multigrain bread or a Twinkie, what exactly are you eating? We all know that the Twinkie is just a processed indulgence, but conventional advice tells us that the former is a better health choice, a source of fiber and B vitamins and rich in complex carbohydrates. Ah, but there's always another layer to the story. Let's peer inside the story. Let's peer inside the contents of this grain and try to understand why, regardless of shape, color, fiber content, organic or not, it potentially does odd things to humans. And that's exactly where we're going next. But unlike Davis's brilliant account of the modern grain and the Battle of the Bulge, we're going to go one step further to see how it can inflict harm where we never imagined before. The brain. Chapter 2. The Sticky Protein. Gluten's role in brain inflammation. It's not just about your belly. Tell me what you eat, I'll tell you who you are. Anthelme Briand Savarin, 1755 to 1826. Most everyone has experienced the throb of a headache and the agony of severe congestion. In many instances, we can point to a probable cause when symptoms descend on us, such as a long day in front of the computer in the case of a tension headache, or a passing cold bug when it hurts to swallow and the nose clogs up. For relief, we can usually turn to over-the-counter remedies to manage our symptoms until the body returns to a normal, healthy state. But what do you do when the symptoms don't go away and the culprit is much harder to pin down? What if, like so many patients I treat, you find yourself in an unending war with nagging pain and misery for years? For as long as she could remember, Fran struggled to chase the pulsating sensation out of her head. When I first examined her on a warm January day, Fran was as pleasant as could be for a 63-year-old who endured daily migraine headaches. Of course, she had tried all the usual headache medications and was taking Imitrex, sumatriptan, a powerful migraine drug, several times a week. In reviewing her medical history, I noted that in her early 20s, she'd undergone intestinal exploratory surgery because she was suffering from severe intestinal discomfort. As part of her evaluation, I tested her for gluten sensitivity, and not to my surprise, found that she was strongly positive in 8 of the markers. I prescribed a gluten-free diet. 4 months later, I received a letter from Fran stating, "My almost daily migraine symptoms have abated since removing gluten from my diet. The two biggest changes in my body are the lack of a very hot head in the night with resulting migraines and the huge increase in my energy levels. Today, my level of daily accomplishment is enormous compared to my life before seeing you." She went on to conclude, "Thank you, once again, for finding what seems to be the solution to my many years of migraine misery. I wish she could have gotten the years back, but at least now I could give her a pain-free future." Another woman who came to me with a totally different set of symptoms but a similarly long history of suffering was Lauren. At just 30 years old, she told me squarely on our first meeting that she was having some mental problems. Lauren detailed the previous 12 years, which she described as a consistent downhill ride in terms of health. She told me how her early life was quite stressful once she lost both her mother and grandmother at a young age. When she started college, she was hospitalized on several occasions for mania. During this time, she would experience episodes of becoming highly talkative and overly grandiose about herself. She would then eat excessively, gain a lot of weight, and become severely depressed and suicidal. She had just started taking lithium, a medication used to treat bipolar disorder. Mental illness ran in her family. Her sister had schizophrenia and her father was bipolar. Aside from Lauren's dramatic account of her mental issues, the rest of her medical history was fairly unremarkable. She had no complaints of bowel issues, food allergies, or any other of the standard types of complaints associated with gluten sensitivity. I went ahead and ordered a test for gluten sensitivity. We found profoundly elevated levels of 6 important markers for the condition. In fact, several of these markers were more than twice the normal range. 2 months after starting Lauren on a gluten-free diet, she wrote a letter to me that echoed what I'd been hearing from so many patients who'd gone gluten-free and experienced striking results. She stated, "Since being off gluten, my life has taken a complete 180. The first change that comes to mind, and the most important one, is my mood. When I was eating gluten, I would struggle with feeling depressed. I would always have to fight a dark cloud over my head. Now that I'm off gluten, I don't feel depressed. The one time I ate some by mistake, I felt depressed again the next day. Other changes I've noticed include having more energy and being able to stay focused for longer periods. My thoughts are as sharp as ever. I can make a decision and come to a logical, confident conclusion like never before. I am also free of a lot of obsessive-compulsive behavior." Let me give you one more example of a case that's emblematic of another set of symptoms linked to the same culprit. Kurt and his mother came to see me when he was a 23-year-old young man suffering from abnormal movements. His mother stated that 6 months prior to their visit, he began looking like he was shivering. Initially, his tremors were subtle, but then they increased with time. He had been to 2 neurologists and received 2 different diagnoses, one for what's called essential tremor and another for dystonia. The doctors had offered him a blood pressure medication, propranolol, which is used to treat some types of tremor disorders. The other recommendation was to have the various muscles in his arms and neck injected with Botox, the botulinum toxin that would temporarily paralyze the spastic muscles. Both he and his mother had elected not to use either the pills or the injections. What was interesting about his history were two things. First, he was diagnosed as having a learning disability in the fourth grade. His mother said that he could not handle excessive stimulation. And second, for several years he had complaints of stomach pain with loose bowel movements to the extent that he had to see a gastroenterologist who took a biopsy of his small intestine to test for celiac disease. It proved negative. When I examined Kurt, his excessive movement problem was very evident. He could not control the shaking of his arms and neck and appeared to be suffering mightily. I reviewed his laboratory studies, which, for the most part, were unrevealing. He had been checked for Huntington's disease, an inherited disorder known to cause a similar movement abnormality in young people, as well as Wilson's disease, a disorder of copper metabolism also associated with a movement abnormality. All of these tests were negative. Blood work for gluten sensitivity did, however, show some elevated levels of certain antibodies indicative of vulnerability. I explained to Kurt and his mother that it was important to make sure gluten sensitivity wasn't the cause of his movement disorder, and I provided them information on how to pursue a gluten-free diet. After several weeks, I received a phone call from Kurt's mother, indicating that without question, his movements had calmed down. Because of his improvement, he elected to stay on a gluten-free diet, and after approximately 6 months, the abnormal movements had all but disappeared completely. The changes that occurred in this young man are breathtaking, especially when you consider that a simple dietary change had such a life-transforming impact. We are just beginning to see medical literature documenting a connection between movement disorders and gluten sensitivity. And physicians like me have now identified and treated a handful of individuals whose movement disorders have completely abated with a gluten-free program and for whom no other cause was identified. But unfortunately, most mainstream doctors are not on the lookout for the dietary explanation for such movement disorders, and they are not aware of the latest reports. These cases are not outliers. They reflect patterns that I've witnessed in so many patients. They all might come to me with vastly different medical complaints, but they share a common thread: gluten sensitivity. It's my belief that gluten is a modern poison, and that the research is compelling doctors like me to notice and re-examine the bigger picture when it comes to brain disorders and disease. The good news is that knowing this common denominator now means we can treat, and in some cases cure, a wide spectrum of ailments with a single prescription: the eviction of gluten from the diet. Walk into any health food store, and now even a regular grocery store, and you're sure to be amazed at the selection of gluten-free products. In the past couple of years, the volume of gluten-free products sold has exploded. At last count, the industry clocked in at $6.3 billion in 2011 and continues to grow. Spin-offs of everything from breakfast cereals to salad dressing are now positioned to take advantage of the ever-increasing number of individuals who are choosing foods without gluten. Why all the hype? No doubt media attention may be playing a role. A 2011 Yahoo Sports article asking, "Is Novak Djokovic's new gluten-free diet behind his winning streak?" goes on to say, "A simple allergy test could have led to one of the most dominant stretches in tennis history." But beyond this one athlete's epiphany, what does the scientific community have to say about gluten sensitivity? What does it mean to be gluten sensitive? How does it differ from celiac disease? What's so bad about gluten? Hasn't it always been around? And just what exactly do I mean by modern grains? Let's take a tour. The glue of gluten. Gluten, which is Latin for glue, is a protein composite that acts as an adhesive material, holding flour together to make bread products, including crackers, baked goods, and pizza dough. When you bite into a fluffy muffin or roll and stretch pizza dough prior to cooking, you have gluten to thank. In fact, most of the soft, chewy bread products available today owe their gumminess to gluten. Gluten plays a key role in the leavening process, letting bread rise when wheat mixes with yeast. To hold a ball of what is essentially gluten in your hands, just mix water and wheat flour, create a dough by kneading the ball with your hands, and then rinse the glob under running water to eliminate the starches and fiber. What you're left with is a glutinous protein mixture. Most Americans consume gluten through wheat, but gluten is found in a variety of grains including rye, barley, spelt, kamut, and bulgur. It's one of the most common food additives on the planet and is used not only in processed foods, but also in personal care products. As a trusty stabilizing agent, it helps cheese spreads and margarines retain their smooth texture, and it prevents sauces and gravies from curdling. Thickening hair conditioners and volumizing mascaras have gluten to thank, too. People can be as allergic to it as they can be to any protein. But let's get a better look at the scope of the problem. Gluten is not a single molecule. It's actually made up of two main groups of proteins, the glutenins and the gliadins. A person may be sensitive to either of these proteins or to one of the 12 different smaller units that make up gliadin. Any of these could cause a sensitivity reaction leading to inflammation. When I speak with patients about gluten sensitivity, one of the first things they say is something like, "Well, I don't have celiac disease, I've been tested." I do my best to explain that there's a huge difference between celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. My aim is to convey the idea that celiac disease, also known as SPRU, is an extreme manifestation of gluten sensitivity. Celiac disease is what happens when an allergic reaction to gluten causes damage specifically to the small intestine. It's one of the most severe reactions one can have to gluten. Although many experts estimate that one in every 200 people has celiac disease, this conservative calculation is probably closer to one in 30, since so many individuals remain undiagnosed. As many as one in four people are vulnerable to the disease due to genetics alone. People of Northern European ancestry are particularly susceptible. What's more, people can carry genes that code for mild versions of gluten intolerance, giving rise to a wide spectrum of gluten sensitivity. Celiac disease doesn't just harm the gut. Once the genes for this disease are triggered, sensitivity to gluten is a lifelong condition that can affect the skin and mucous membranes, as well as cause blisters in the mouth. Extreme reactions that trigger an autoimmune condition such as celiac aside, the key to understanding gluten sensitivity is that it can involve any organ in the body, even if the small intestine is completely spared. So while a person may not have celiac disease by definition, the rest of the body, including the brain, is at great risk if that individual is gluten sensitive. It helps to understand that food sensitivities in general are usually a response from the immune system. They can also occur if the body lacks the right enzymes to digest ingredients in foods. In the case of gluten, its sticky attribute interferes with the breakdown and absorption of nutrients. As you can imagine, poorly digested food leads to a pasty residue in your gut, which alerts the immune system to leap into action, eventually resulting in an assault on the lining of the small intestine. Those who experience symptoms complain of abdominal pain, nausea, diarrhea, constipation, and intestinal distress. Some people, however, don't experience obvious signs of gastrointestinal trouble, but they could nevertheless be experiencing a silent attack elsewhere in their body, such as in their nervous system. Remember that when a body negatively reacts to food, it attempts to control the damage by sending out inflammatory messenger molecules to label the food particles as enemies. This leads the immune system to keep sending out inflammatory chemicals, killer cells among them, in a bid to wipe out the enemies. The process often damages our tissue, leaving the walls of our intestine compromised, a condition known as leaky gut. Once you have a leaky gut, you're highly susceptible to additional food sensitivities in the future, and the onslaught of inflammation can also put you at risk for developing autoimmune disease. Inflammation, which you know by now is the cornerstone of many brain disorders, can be initiated when the immune system reacts to a substance in a person's body. When antibodies of the immune system come into contact with a protein or antigen to which a person is allergic, the inflammatory cascade is provoked, releasing a whole host of damaging chemicals known as cytokines. Gluten sensitivity in particular is caused by elevated levels of antibodies against the gliadin component of gluten. When the antibody combines with this protein, creating an anti-gliadin antibody, specific genes are turned on in a special type of immune cell in the body. Once these genes are activated, inflammatory cytokine chemicals collect and can attack the brain. Cytokines are highly antagonistic to the brain, damaging tissue and leaving the brain vulnerable to dysfunction and disease, especially if the assault continues. Another problem with anti-gliadin antibodies is that they can directly combine with specific proteins found in the brain that look like the gliadin protein found in gluten-containing foods. But the anti-gliadin antibodies just can't tell the difference. This has been described for decades and again leads to the formation of more inflammatory cytokines. Given this, it's no wonder that elevated cytokines are seen in Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and even autism. Research has even shown that some people who are wrongly diagnosed with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease simply have a sensitivity to gluten, and eliminating it from the diet resolves the symptoms. As England's Professor Marios Hadzivassiliou, one of the most well-respected researchers in the area of gluten sensitivity and the brain, at the Royal Hallamshire Hospital in Sheffield, reported in a 1996 article in The Lancet. Our data suggest that gluten sensitivity is common in patients with neurological disease of unknown cause and may have etiological significance. For someone like me who deals with challenging brain disorders of unknown cause on a daily basis, Dr. Hadzivassiliou's statement is sobering when you consider that an estimated 99% of people whose immune systems react negatively to gluten don't even know it. Dr. Hadzivassiliou goes on to state that gluten sensitivity can be primarily, and at times exclusively, a neurological disease. In other words, people with gluten sensitivity can have issues with brain function without having any gastrointestinal problems whatsoever. For this reason, he tests all of his patients who have unexplained neurological disorders for gluten sensitivity. I love how Dr. Hadzivassiliou and his colleagues stated the facts in a 2002 editorial to the Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery and Psychiatry, titled Gluten Sensitivity as a Neurological Illness. It has taken nearly 2,000 years to appreciate that a common dietary protein introduced to the human diet relatively late in evolutionary terms, some 10,000 years ago, can produce human disease not only of the gut, but also the skin and the nervous system. The protean neurological manifestations of gluten sensitivity can occur without gut involvement, and neurologists must therefore become familiar with the common neurological presentations and means of diagnosis of this disease. In addition, the editorial summed up the findings brilliantly in the conclusion, which reiterated statements made in earlier papers. Gluten sensitivity is best defined as a state of heightened immunological responsiveness in genetically susceptible people. This definition does not imply bowel involvement. That gluten sensitivity is regarded as principally a disease of the small bowel is a historical misconception. Celiac through the centuries. Although the relationship between gluten sensitivity and neurological disease has received precious little attention in the medical literature, we can trace a prominent thread of accumulating knowledge back thousands of years to a time when gluten wasn't even part of our vocabulary. The evidence, it turns out, was already mounting. We just weren't able to document it until the current century. The fact that we can finally identify a link between celiac disease, which again is the strongest reaction to gluten, and neurological problems has implications for all of us, including those who don't have celiac. The study of celiac patients has enabled us to zoom in on the real dangers of gluten that have largely remained hidden and silent for so long. Celiac may seem like a new disease, but the first descriptions of the disorder date back to the 1st century AD, when Aretaeus of Cappadocia, one of the most distinguished ancient Greek doctors, wrote about it in a medical textbook covering various conditions, including neurological abnormalities such as epilepsy, headache, vertigo, and paralysis. Aretaeus was also the first to use the word celiac, which is Greek for abdominal. In describing this malady, he said, "The stomach, being the digestive organ, labors in digestion when diarrhea seizes the patient, and if, in addition, the patient's general system be debilitated by atrophy of the body, the celiac disease of a chronic nature is formed." In the 17th century, the term sproe was introduced into the English language from the Dutch word sproe, which means chronic diarrhea, one of the classic symptoms of celiac disease. The English pediatrician Dr. Samuel J. Gee was among the first to recognize the importance of diet in managing patients with celiac. He gave the first modern-day description of the condition in children in a lecture at a London hospital in 1887, noting, "If the patient can be cured at all, it must be by means of diet." At the time, however, no one could pinpoint which ingredient was the culprit, so recommendations in dietary changes in search of a cure were far from accurate. Dr. G, for example, banned fruits and vegetables, which wouldn't have posed a problem, but allowed thin slices of toasted bread. He was particularly moved by the curing of a child who was fed upon a quart of the best Dutch mussels daily, but who relapsed when the season of mussels was over. Perhaps the child went back to eating toast. In the United States, the first discussion of the disorder was published in 1908, when Dr. Christian Herter wrote a book about children with celiac disease, which he called Intestinal Infantilism. As others had noted previously, he wrote that these children failed to thrive and added that they tolerated fat better than carbohydrate. Then, in 1924, Sidney V. Haas, an American pediatrician, reported positive effects of a diet of bananas. Obviously, bananas weren't the cause of the improvement, but rather the banana diet happened to exclude gluten. While it's hard to imagine such a diet enduring the test of time, it remained popular until the actual cause of celiac could be determined and confirmed. And this would take another couple of decades, until the 1940s, when the Dutch pediatrician Dr. Willem Karel Dicke made the connection to wheat flour. By then, carbohydrates in general had long been suspected, but not until a cause and effect observation could be made with wheat in particular did we see the direct connection. And how was this discovery actually made? During the Dutch famine of 1944, bread and flour were scarce, and Dr. Dicke noticed that there was a dramatic decrease in the death rate among children affected by celiac, from greater than 35% to virtually zero. Dr. Dicke also reported that once wheat was again available, the mortality rate rose to previous levels. Finally, in 1952, a team of doctors from Birmingham, England, including Dr. Dicke, made the link between the ingestion of wheat proteins and celiac disease when they examined samples of intestinal mucosa taken from surgical patients. The introduction of the small bowel biopsy in the 1950s and 60s confirmed the gut as a target organ. To be fair, I should note that historical experts have debated whether or not Dicke's earlier anecdotal observations in the Netherlands were completely correct, arguing that it would have been difficult, if not impossible, for him to record such a relapse when flour became available again. But these debaters are not dismissing the importance of identifying wheat as a culprit. They merely aim to highlight the fact wheat isn't the only culprit. So when did we begin to see a connection between celiac and neurological issues? Again, the trail goes back much further than most people realize. More than a century ago, the first anecdotal reports began to emerge, and throughout the 20th century, various doctors documented neurological conditions in patients with celiac. Early on, though, when neurological problems were found to correlate to celiac disease, by and large, they were thought to represent a manifestation of nutritional deficiencies because of the gut issue. In other words, doctors didn't think a certain ingredient was necessarily wreaking havoc on the nervous system. They just thought the celiac condition itself, which prevented the absorption of nutrients and vitamins in the gut, led to deficiencies that triggered neurological problems like nerve damage and even cognitive impairments. And they were far from being able to grasp the role of inflammation in the story, which had yet to enter our medical library of knowledge. In 1937, the Archives of Internal Medicine published the Mayo Clinic's first review of neurological involvement in patients with celiac. But even then, the research could not accurately describe the real cascade of events. They attributed the brain involvement to electrolyte depletion, due principally to the gut's failure to digest and absorb nutrients properly. To reach the point where we could understand and fully explain the link between sensitivity to gluten and the brain, we needed a great deal of advancements in our technology, not to mention our understanding of the role of inflammatory pathways. But the turnaround in our perspective has indeed been sensational and relatively recent. In 2006, the Mayo Clinic again came out with a report, published in the Archives of Neurology, about celiac disease and cognitive impairment, but this time, the conclusion was a game-changer. A possible association exists between progressive cognitive impairment and celiac disease, given the temporal relationship and the relatively high frequency of ataxia and peripheral neuropathy, more commonly associated with celiac disease. Ataxia is the inability to control voluntary muscle movement and maintain balance, most frequently resulting from disorders in the brain. Peripheral neuropathy is a fancy way of saying nerve damage. It encompasses a wide range of disorders in which the damaged nerves outside of the brain and spinal cord, peripheral nerves, cause numbness, weakness, or pain. In this particular study, the researchers looked at 13 patients who showed signs of progressive cognitive decline within 2 years of the onset of celiac disease symptoms or a worsening of the disorder. The most common reasons why these patients sought medical help for their brain impairments were amnesia, confusion, and personality changes. Doctors confirmed all cases of celiac disease by small bowel biopsy. Anyone whose cognitive decline could potentially be pinned on an alternate cause were excluded. One thing became clear during the analysis that instantly invalidated previous thinking. The cognitive decline could not be attributed to nutritional deficiencies. What's more, doctors noted that the patients were relatively young to have dementia. The median age when signs of cognitive impairment began was 64 years, with a range from 45 to 79 years. As reported in the media, according to Dr. Joseph Murray, a Mayo Clinic gastroenterologist and the study investigator, there has been a fair amount written before about celiac disease and neurological issues like peripheral neuropathy, or balance problems, but this degree of brain problem, the cognitive decline we've found here, has not been recognized before. I was not expecting there would be so many celiac disease patients with cognitive decline. Murray rightfully went on to add that it's unlikely these patients' conditions reflected a chance connection. Given the association between the celiac symptoms starting or worsening and the cognitive decline within just 2 years, the likelihood of this being a random event was very small. Perhaps the most stunning finding of all in this study was that several of the patients who were put on a gluten-free diet experienced significant improvement in their cognitive decline. When they completely withdrew from gluten consumption, three patients' mental faculties either improved or stabilized, leading